Santa Muerte, or Saint Death, is pictured as a female skeleton in robes. Her shrines are found in Mexican prison cells and drug houses. She presides over the shadowy battleground of the war between the Gulf Cartel and Los Zetas. Hi, this is Per Fagring, host of Fight the Empire. Thursday, I'll be speaking with Michael Diebert, author of In the Shadow of Saint Death. That's Thursday, July 3rd at 9:30 a.m. In the Shadow of Saint Death on KBOO, your radio station.
And good morning. It's 10 o'clock, almost 10:01. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned at 11 for the KBOO Bike Show, where the topic is bike packing. We'll hear Donnie Kolb, creator of VeloDirt.com and the Oregon Outback bikepacking route. Maria Schur will tell her Oregon Outback story, and Jay Peterberry, ultra-distance cyclist, will share his experiences. And for now, it's 10:01, and we're going to go straight to Flashpoints today. Eric Cascadia is off. Thank you for listening to KBOO Community Radio.
Flashpoints, Obama sending more troops to Iraq and more drone attacks expected. Also, a massive air attack against Gaza by Israeli occupiers as Israeli vigilantes threaten to kill elected Arab politicians in Israel. And Native Americans arrested at Giant Stadium during Native American Heritage Night. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, Obama now is adding more troops. In addition to the earlier deployments, the Pentagon is announcing now, confirming that it has ordered additional U.S. soldiers, maybe 300 or 400 more, pumping it up to 600 or 800 soldiers. Well, they're joining a lot of people who are already on the ground, and our next guest knows a lot about that and knows a lot about what's going on there in terms of this expansion. Arun Gupta is an independent reporter. He's reported extensively for The Progressive, Truth Out in These Times, and The Guardian, and he joins us today from Chicago at the offices of In These Times. Arun Gupta, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Great to be on with you today, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. You know, I'm thinking about this story that my dad told me once. It's sort of about this guy, and he's on the boardwalk. It's late at night, and he's on his knees looking for his keys under the one lamp there on the boardwalk. And some stranger walks by and says to the guy on his knees looking for his keys, "What are you doing down there?" And the guy on his knees says, "Well, I'm looking for my keys." And the stranger says, "But are you sure you lost them there?" And the guy on his knees says, "No, but this is the only place where there's some light." And the next line in the story is, "And so to war." And here we go back again. I want to get your response to the extension of troops, more war in Iraq. And these guys, these 600 or 800 folks going in, they're not going to be alone because there are many armed folks representing the United States already on the ground. You want to talk about your response to what's going on?
Yeah, I think that's also a nice little intro, because the light in this case is the lens of sectarianism, and that's how the current conflict, or the current stage of what is a conflict that's been going on for over 30 years, is being represented, that this is just something that should be understood in very simple sectarian terms about extremism, about endless communal antagonisms, when it is not at all about the case. Now, in terms of the news today, you know, the U.S. is increasing its forces considerably one report I saw said 750 U.S. troops, and it's not just U.S. troops. Apparently, there are also attack helicopters and armed drones. The U.S. doesn't want to have another Benghazi situation if the fighting does come to Baghdad. So hundreds of U.S. forces have been deployed to protect the embassy. And this embassy is the largest embassy, the American embassy in the entire world. It has thousands of employees and workers in it. And it's also believed to be the largest CIA station in the entire world, with hundreds of CIA personnel, if not over 1,000. Now, there are also thousands of security contractors, you know, like everything in the world today, what gets reported, what you see, like with Wall Street, you know, you only see the tip of the iceberg. When the U.S. formally left Iraq, quote unquote, in the end of 2011, it put contracts in place for 5,500 security contractors. So there's this entire mercenary army that was left behind. And frankly, we don't know if this is being expanded. There could have been thousands of U.S. contractors who've been flown into or shipped into Iraq, or at least what are called third-party nationals. A lot of these contractors outsource the mercenary work to locate military personnel from the third world, you know, from Africa, from Latin America, from Asia. So we really don't know what the constitution of the entire forces are, but I think it is safe to say that the U.S. is basically re-upping its involvement in this conflict in a serious way.
Would it be the case that these folks, these private contractors already on the ground, will they be directly linking up? Will they be sharing intelligence? How will they work with the expanding forces now landing once again in Baghdad?
Well, they really act as an appendage of the U.S. military. Another investigative reporter that Flashpoint listeners may be familiar with, Pratap Chatterjee, he did a great book on the outsourcing of military services and responsibilities to the private sector in Iraq. I can't remember the exact title of that book. But what was interesting about his account was, you know, there's always these allegations, and not just allegations, hard evidence of illegal behavior, of crimes, of massacres. And, you know, as we're talking about this, of course, you have the Blackwater Guards who are now on trial for the second time for the massacre in Omnisur Square in 2007, where they killed 17 civilians. But Chatterjee's book, what was great about it was it showed how the Pentagon was indifferent to all of this, because the security contractors serve a very important role. They call them a force multiplier, right? The U.S. has cut its forces significantly over the years, and even though it has about, you know, like 500,000 troops in the U.S. Army, it has global commitments. And so by being able to outsource a lot of functions, especially communications, logistics, intelligence, et cetera, to the security contractors, it allows it to rely on skeleton forces, but it also uses security contractors directly as armed guards. They provide much of the security for State Department and embassy personnel in Iraq. So I think, you know, we don't really, shouldn't really view these as separate forces. They are very much part of the Pentagon in this day and age. And then also there's all the intelligence contractors, whom we really don't know anything about because this is all on the black budget. So who knows how many hundreds or thousands of intelligence contractors. And then, of course, you also have all the regional, because, you know, to have forces with sophisticated 21st century military, you need all sorts of regional support. So again, you know, when we hear about 750 U.S. troops are going into Iraq, I think we can be reasonably certain you're talking about 10, 20, 50 times more are actually either in Iraq or providing support throughout the region.
Well, there's a huge base in Saudi Arabia. that the U.S. can draw upon for sure. And, well, could you describe the embassy there in Iraq is monstrous. It's huge, right? So they have a whole part of Baghdad that they now control, where hundreds, if not thousands, of U.S. Related operatives are working, right? This is a huge operation on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember what the call. I think the embassy alone costs $500 million to build. It's in the heart of Baghdad. It's some of the most important real estate, and of course, it has layers and layers of walls and security and perimeters and blast barriers, bunkers. And if you're talking about that, they have the capability to launch armed drones and helicopters, if not from that area or at least nearby. It starts to give you a sense of, Americans love their alien invasion movies, and yet this is like a permanent alien invasion in the heart of Baghdad. What's going on with the embassy there? And of course, there's so many hundreds of CIA personnel and intelligence personnel, you begin to understand that this is a very important site to the United States. And I think what we really need to understand is that the U.S. wants a weak state. It wants a destabilized state, right? Since Iraq has come back into the media eye after being out of it for so many years. The reporting all presents the U.S. as, it's kind of this innocence abroad that, we're caught off guard and that we're just trying to negotiate between these factions that have been at each other's throats for 1,300 years. When the truth is we use sectarianism as a direct policy in the war and then in the counterinsurgency strategy. In other words, when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, the policy was to punish Sunni Arabs, right? So we had the de-Ba'athification program, we had the disbanding of the army, we had the firing of thousands of government employees, the attempt to privatize the state-owned enterprises, basically all these factories that the government ran and which many Sunnis benefited from. So it was directly an attempt to punish the Sunni population. And then, surprise, surprise, combine that with an occupation, especially of all these young Americans who can't speak a word of Arabic but are armed to the teeth and who start killing civilians. You have an insurgency that begins to grow up. So then the U.S. response after that was to create these sectarian death squads. So it was really the U.S. who introduced a lot of the sectarianism in Iraq, and this narrative that they're eternally at each other's throats is just simply ridiculous.
I'm wondering your thoughts on, we've got this huge embassy in Baghdad and this expanding war, the borders between Syria and Iraq disappearing. You've got the Kurds taking advantage or acting on their own behalf. It seems that embassy there in Iraq could be main headquarters, central headquarters for the sort of the U.S.'s expanding war into Syria.
I mean, the U.S. policy towards Syria has, I think, very much been a mess, because it nominally opposes the Assad regime, which is quite brutal. But obviously, there's also the situation of the devil it knows. Like, at any point, Israel could have mobilized a large amount of troops to put on its border with Syria, which would have completely destabilized the Assad regime. So I think, the fact that they never did that indicates that they wanted to keep him in power, but are fine to see him significantly weakened because of how this conflict has regionalized over the last decade, right? Because the Assad regime is allied with Iran as well as Hezbollah in Lebanon. Then you also have the uprising in Bahrain by the Shia, the democratic nonviolent uprising that was crushed by the Gulf Cooperation Council, which is basically the Sunni medieval monarchies that are aligned with the U.S., led by Saudi Arabia, because they have their own Shia populations who are agitating for more rights. But I think we also have to understand that when I say not to focus on the sectarian, so much of this is about the economy. It's about class. It's about resources and then the political power that flows from it. And, of course, you can't talk about that without talking about oil. So, you know, in Saudi Arabia, the Saudi monarchy has severely repressed the Shia, which is concentrated in the eastern half of the country, which also happens to be where there are huge reserves of oil. That's why it went into Bahrain to crush the uprising there, because it didn't want its own population to get any ideas of rising up. In Lebanon, the Shia have been historically oppressed there. And, of course, in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, there was also significant repression of the Shia. But a lot of this narrative that, oh, the Shia had been repressed under the British rule and then the post-British monarchy and then revolution actually isn't really true. The Shia actually did quite well, or at least a segment of them. They were the largest landowners. They made up the merchant class in southern Iraq. They served. There were many Shia that served in the ministry. It's only when you see Saddam Hussein coming to power where he's relying on his own kinship that works for power, where you start to see more repression directly of the Shia community. And then post-Gulf War, which is, of course, when the U.S. urged the Shia community to rise up against Iran, then you see more direct repression there as well. But this idea that it's an internal communal conflict is just a comic book version of history.
And the idea that it came up out of the blue, that all of a sudden lots of people are dying, is also, the ignorance around that is a result of corporate press, U.S. press reporting. But there ain't anything about the violence that's new either, is it? It's just been getting worse.
Yeah, and also, you know, it's in the interest of the Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, who was essentially put in power by the United States, right? We have to understand this as well, that the previous Prime Minister, Jafari, the U.S. opposed him after the parliamentary elections in 2006 because he was seen as too close to Muqtada al-Sadr, who is the charismatic preacher in Baghdad, who commands the loyalty of millions of the poorest of the poor, Shia, and who have been screwed over by every single government. And so Jafari was seen as too close to Sadr and his forces and allies. So the U.S. blocked him becoming prime minister again and supported al-Maliki. So, you know, he really came to power because of the U.S. And now the way it gets reported is like, oh, he's just this, you know, sectarian figure who the U.S. has tried to keep under check, which is completely absurd. And what also gets lost is that it was the U.S. that set up these sectarian death squads. The reporting on that, there's been very little reporting on that that I've noticed in the last month or so, but when there was a lot of reporting on it even a decade ago, it presented these death squads as, again, some sort of indigenous creation, when the fact of the matter was it was the U.S. under General David Petraeus who armed them, funded them, and trained them. And they were used to carry out a dirty war against the Sunni Arab community, because that's where the resistance, much of the resistance was based. But again, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that there were multiple resistances going on within the Sunni Arab community, and there was also an armed resistance by al-Sadr's forces and other Shia forces in Baghdad and Basra.
Finally, before we let you go, Arun Gupta, and we do appreciate the time, what are your concerns about where this is going now? And maybe sort of put into that the way in which we see the United States working very closely with the Saudis in the midst of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated, right? Because the Saudis, there's persistent allegations that ISIL, you know, you cannot take over a large territorial swaths and administer them with you basically have the trappings of the state, right? You know, how did the Taliban actually come to power? Because they were supported by the Saudis, they were supported by the Pakistan intelligence services, and it was supported by the U.S., specifically the Clinton administration, because they were seen as a stabilizing force. But to be able to take over these large areas, you need administration, you need logistics, you need communications, you need bureaucracies. This is not something that, you know, just a ragtag band of armed militants can do. So we have to ask, like, you know, if ISIS or ISIL, whatever you want to call them, are really taking over and administering these areas, then who is really providing the support and how is it being carried out? And again, we should lose sight of the fact that also what is going on is that there are Sunni communities that are being persecuted, that are finding an alliance of convenience with the jihadis because they hate the government even more. There's no love for the jihadis among many of the Sunni communities in Mosul and Fallujah and Ramadi and elsewhere. But the repression from the U.S.-backed government has been so extreme that they're willing to throw their lot in for now with them.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there, but it really does help shed a whole bunch of light on a very complicated situation that's probably going to get a lot worse before it gets better. I know last we spoke to you, you were talking to some 12,000 Iraqis who had gone into exile in the United States. There are about 1 million more people on the run now on the ground in Iraq. There seems to be no let up in sight for the suffering of the Iraqi folks in this world.
You know, let's not forget the U.S. has been tormenting Iraq for over 30 years. It really encouraged Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. Then it armed both sides during the Iran-Iraq War, then the Persian Gulf War, then the sanctions, then, you know, years of bombing, then the invasion, then the occupation. I mean, you know, the blood is really on our hands. So for us to act like innocents is, it's typical of Americans, but also completely delusional.
I want to thank Arun Gupta, independent reporter, has reported extensively for the Progressive Truth Out in these times. The Guardian, he's now talking to us from Chicago in the offices of In These Times. And again, we thank you so much for being with us on Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me, Dana.
All right, bye-bye now.
Take care.
Ian Berkley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. In one moment, we'll be joined by Ali Al-Banima to talk about, the expanded violence that Israel has perpetrated now in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip based on the finding of three soldiers, settlers, not sure who these folks are, not sure who kidnapped them. But let's hear what it was like to be in the Gaza Strip last night. Here's Mohammed.
I'm Mohammed. I'm Mohammed Hajjaj. Okay, I live in Gaza, in the eastern part of Gaza Strip. I'm a translator and writer for international agencies. I'm 28. Well, everybody in Gaza was, you know, was watching the World Cup games last night. Actually, when the bombing started so crazy last night, after, you know, the news released that the three missing soldiers were found dead. Okay. I think more than 20 or 30, but 30 or 16 started bombing so crazy everywhere. They bombed, you know, so many different sites in Gaza. It's really the hugest, the biggest since the gas lid.
So it was felt across the Gaza Strip, people across the... Did you know if they hit any houses? Have you heard any reports about anybody being hurt or killed or wounded?
Well, yeah, I heard about four people were injured, okay? Luckily, nobody was killed because most of, you know, the governmental and the security buildings were evacuated in front, okay? So number of casualties were so little this time.
And what does it feel like? I mean, do your houses shake?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was the bombing started at the exact moment when we were going home, okay? and all the buildings were shaking, and you could hear serials of explosions, okay, 5 to 10 at once, okay, and serial, okay, and everything around you is shaking, and the land even is shaking, and the huge voices were so loud, okay, and, you know, the drones were so, you know, so apparent. You could see and hear the drones.
So there were bombings, there were drones, there was the fighter jet attacks. And what are people thinking at this point? Do people feel that this is just in another example of collective punishment based on the... Do people think that maybe the Israelis are going to hit harder now that everybody's watching Iraq? Are you worried that you're in more jeopardy?
Yeah, exactly. We all have the same feeling because, you know, everybody is busy with his own business. And all most of, you know, the international community eyes are focused on Iraq and Syria, okay? Everybody's really scared of, you know, another war, okay, and a massive escalation, okay? And it's really another round of collective punishment. We have been punished for something that hasn't been proved yet, okay? They found the 3 dead soldiers, and they claim that they are still searching for the 2 kidnappers, okay, and they haven't given any proof that the kidnappers are, you know, has anything to do with Gaza. So we're being collectively punished again and again.
All right. I want to thank you for taking the time out to speak with us from the Gaza Strip. We urge you to be careful and do appreciate the time.
Thank you, sir. You're welcome anytime.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Now we're joined by Ali Abanima. He's the founder of the electronicintifada.net. He joins us from Chicago. Ali, welcome back to Flashpoints. It is now a very dangerous time to be a Palestinian in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. Things are not good.
Hi, Dennis. Yes, you know, the mood in Israel is one of almost across-the-board demands for bloody revenge. This is something I've been documenting at the Electronic Intifada. And there are mobs in the streets of Jerusalem going around and crying out death to the Arabs and promising revenge. Ben Wedderman, the veteran CNN correspondent, just tweeted that he'd been told by someone in one of these mobs that was chanting death to the Arabs that we're going to attack them, meaning Palestinians, after sundown. And I wish I could say this was simply a small fringe, but it's coming from the top. Yesterday I wrote a piece about the statements from many members of the Israeli cabinet, including Prime Minister Netanyahu, calling for revenge. And that seems to be the mood. There really aren't that many heads of state, especially, you know, from countries claiming to be democracies, that endorse this kind of vigilante action. And so it's a situation where the Israeli street, let's say, is calling for blood, but internationally Israel is being called to kind of keep a lid on it, because the United States right now, you know, the last thing that the U.S. wants is, you know, another one of Israel's massacres when, you know, everything else is going so wrong in the region. So it's very tense. Palestinians are, you know, already under attack. They've been under collective punishment for weeks. But now the question is, what more will Israel do to them?
Now, what do we know about who the settlers were and what they were doing and what happened? Is there any claim to responsibility, any indication of evidence on this?
Well, what we know is that these were 3 students in yeshiva, a Jewish religious school in one of the settlements in the occupied West Bank. 2 of them were minors, children, age 16, and one was 19, so a teenager, a youth. I have seen reports saying they were soldiers, but I've seen no evidence at all that they were actually at any point inducted in the army. People circulated some photos of, you know, that purported to be them, but I didn't see a resemblance, and I've seen nothing credible that says they were actually in the army. They appeared to be youths who either live in settlements or who certainly went to school in the settlement, and they were abducted while hitchhiking. The story goes from the Israelis that they were abducted. There is now this recording that has been released of the phone call one of them is said to have made to the police shortly after the abduction. It's very muffled. Transcripts have been published in the Israeli media, and it is said that shots can actually be heard. I listened to it, and it's not easy to make out what happens, but it seems to be that loud noises, very likely shots are heard, and that the young men were killed at that time. Israel has claimed that Hamas carried out the attack, but you know, even some of the Israeli intelligence bigwigs are saying in the media yesterday, a former Israeli consul general told Al Jazeera I was on that program when he said it, that the assessment is that this was not ordered by Hamas leaders, but that it might have been by a couple of Hamas members acting by themselves. Israel has named two men who it says carried them out, but of course, you know, those are Israeli allegations and there's no proof, or at least no publicly available evidence. These men have been missing for some time, presumed to be on the run, and Israel says that they are the suspects. Yesterday night, Israeli forces went to the family homes of these families in Hebron and trashed their homes, blew parts of them up, set them on fire, trashed them in an apparent act of retribution and collective punishment. So that's what we know at this point. The Israelis are promising revenge. It's very likely that that revenge will claim many more innocent victims. And last night, one of those victims was Yusuf Abu Zakka, a Palestinian youth who was shot dead by Israeli forces in Jenin refugee camp.
Now, we know that Israel has been fuming and worse in terms of trying to keep a divide between, you know, what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank, Fatah versus Hamas. Do you want to talk about what Israel has been trying to do in terms of undermining Palestinian unity and maybe using this moment to further that cause?
Yes, Israel has used these youth abduction and then now their deaths in very cynical ways, in a way sort of using these young men as human shields. A striking example of that is the Israeli defense minister saying that Israel should massively expand settlements in the West Bank and name the new settlements after the youth. So a really cynical way to use these deaths to justify more land grabs. But even before that, really the moment these youths were taken on June 12th, Israel began a massive operation. It looks like it was a pre-planned operation that they just, you know, pushed the button on to really attack Hamas's organizational structure in the West Bank. And they made no secret that this was really, you know, they were just seizing this opportunity to go after Hamas, arresting members of parliament, ransacking charities, ransacking universities, literary magazines, you name it, businesses, crushing hundreds of homes, arresting more than 560 Palestinians, and the vast majority of whom could have had no plausible connection to this abduction. But for Israel, this was an opportunity, and, you know, they took it to push their goals. And part of that, of course, was to maintain the policy of divide and rule, as you mentioned. And in that, they had, of course, the willful complicity of the Palestinian Authority led by Mahmoud Abbas, which all along has been assisting Israel in its operations against Palestinians. And they are believed to have fingered the two men in Hebron.
There was concern, we just heard it from our friend in the Gaza Strip, that given how much is going on in the region, the battles happening in Iraq, in Syria, the flood of refugees going in every direction, that people in the Gaza Strip feel particularly vulnerable because Israeli tends to move under this kind of cover.
Well, I think that's very understandable and historically a very accurate framing. I think there's a number of factors that push in the other direction. I mean, not to underestimate the terror that Israel is imposing on Gaza night by night. I mean, friends in Gaza last night were tweeting and telling us about, you know, the huge explosions, the absolute terror that the explosions of Israel's bombing causes, even when, you know, nobody is killed or injured. It's the constant terror, the constant sense of fear, of anxiety, which Israel intends to impose on 1.7 million people. There's no underestimating that. It is terrorism. It is state terrorism. The question, I think, on many people's minds is, does Israel intend to go further than that? And the signals for now are that they are reluctant to do so, in part because of international pressure. Again, when the U.S. calls on Israel to show restraint, let's be clear, this is not out of any sympathy or concern for Palestinians. It's that the U.S. feels that strategically and politically, it cannot afford for Israel to go on one of its rampages at the time when, you know, the U.S. is trying to get a grip on the chaos it has created elsewhere in the region. So both Israel and Hamas have made statements publicly saying that they're not interested in an escalation. So at least for now, it looks like, you know, that things may not get worse in Gaza, but that's very little comfort given how bad things are on a day-to-day basis. You know, normal in Gaza is far from what anyone else in the world would consider normal.
And finally, back to where we started, sort of vigilantism in Israel. Now, we know that it's not just Jews that live in Israel proper, let's call it. Are these actions that you described at the beginning of this interview, directed in neighborhoods where there are Arab communities who will be fearful or impacted by them?
Oh, I'm sure that they will. And yesterday, B'Tselem, the human rights organization, issued a warning to the government against carrying out revenge attacks on Palestinians. But also B'Tselem warned that settlers in the West Bank would engage in revenge attacks. And that's something that is ongoing. So sadly, I expect that we will see a surge of violence against Palestinians throughout the country, not just in the West Bank, but, you know, in Jerusalem, in Jaffa, in Haifa, wherever Palestinians are, there will be this kind of incitement. So it's a very tense and dangerous situation. Of course, also the incitement that we're monitoring and seeing online, a lot of it is directed at the leaders of Palestinians in Israel, particularly the Knesset member Hanin Zoabi, just really pervasive on Israeli social media, pervasive calls for violence against her. It's a very alarming and worrying level of incitement.
When you say calls for violence, you mean direct attacks? What are they saying? And is it legal? If you will.
You know, it's legal on Facebook because people have complained about it and Facebook seems to have no problem with it. But what we're documenting, and I've written about some of this on the Electronic Intifada, there's so much, you can only scratch the surface. But direct calls for violence, incitement against individuals, particularly Hanin Zoabi, but also generalized calls to go out and attack Palestinians, attack Arabs, burn them, kill them, mutilate their bodies. It's horrifying, and I wish I could tell you, look, this is just a couple of people, but it's actually pervasive. You go on mainstream Israeli news websites or Facebook pages of Israeli mainstream media, and you look at the comments, and, you know, just about every comment is of this kind of nature, with very, very, very few calls for restraint or for people to kind of check these vengeful and violent thoughts. It's a symptom of a settler society that, you know, is in a mass psychosis. And this is not new. This is the same phenomenon that you see when they're attacking Gaza or when any other things are happening. But it's just, you know, in kind of an almost unprecedented upsurge right now.
All right. We're going to leave it right there. Ali Abunima, founder of the Electronic Intifada. Ali, thanks for taking the time out to be with us.
Thank you, Dennis. I appreciate it.
All right, bye-bye now.
Dear Mr. Policeman, please move your hand off my brother's neck. Mm-hmm. Dear Mr. Policeman, please move your hand off my sister's neck. Dear Mr. Policeman, please move your hand off my brother's neck. Dear Mr. Policeman, please move your hand off my sister's.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, on June 23rd, this year at the San Francisco Giants game versus the San Diego Padres. That was called Native American Heritage Night. But two Native American fans in attendance at the game, Kimball Big Horse and April Negrete, were forcefully detained and removed from the game for confronting another fan wearing a fake costume headdress. This turned into a bit of a scene, and instead of honoring the feelings of the Native Americans, they were treated to, well, the stadium, the owners of the Giants, called the police. The police roughed up these young folks. They were put on their faces, their tickets were taken, and they were thrown out and brutalized in the process. And they're not happy about it. And joining us to talk about it is April Negrete. She was there on the 23rd, and she's going to be there again tonight. April, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis.
It's good to have you with us. Explain what was happening. I guess you were really excited that day. They were going to honor Native Americans. You brought your younger sister. Talk a little bit. Set the scene.
Okay, so like you mentioned, me and my little sister had came over to the game because it was Native American Heritage Night, and she really likes the Giants too. So we thought, well, this was probably a great day to go, you know, two for one, Native heritage and get to see our team play. So we're over there. I was sitting there eating my garlic fries, and my sister goes, "Oh my God, that guy's wearing a headdress!" And I turn around and see, back a couple sections over in the bleachers, there's a guy wearing a costume headdress. It's got like red, white, and blue plastic feathers on it. I thought, oh. So I got up to go over there to talk to the guy because I've talked to several people before about wearing headdresses. I realized that if you come at people with a very educational standpoint and come at them just trying to explain why that's not okay, a lot of people are really receptive to it. So I thought, well, okay, it's Native American Heritage Night. He obviously thinks this is cool. He's into the culture, maybe in the wrong way, but in some way. So I'll go talk to him. So I talked to him, and he wasn't quite that understanding, but he took it off. So I was like, okay, that's fine. It's off.
And why do you find that offensive?
I find it offensive because it's an honor to wear a headdress for the cultures that partake in that. You have to earn every feather that's on there. It's not something that you just pick off the ground and make and wear. It's kind of equivalent to, say, a person in the military earning a Medal of Honor or earning a Purple Heart. And that's kind of the way that is viewed. And it's really offensive to do that because you're not only not respecting that culture, but you're parading it around and perpetuating these stereotypes that affect our communities at the same time.
So you had this discussion with this guy. You were crying. He took off the headdress and he gave it to you.
Yeah. So, well, the first guy took it off. I went and sat back down. He gave it to another guy who then put it back on in the same group. So I went over there again, this time with Kimball. Kimball was just a stranger at that time. I didn't even know him. He was just sitting next to me.
And he's Native American.
Yeah, and he's Native also. And we had just got to talking, and he saw me going back over there. And I said, hey, why don't you come with me? So he gets up, and he comes with me over there. So I'm talking to the second gentleman. He was the one that made me start crying because he was just not listening to anything I was saying. He's like, well, we have a Native friend, and he said it's okay, so it must be all right. And I just burst into tears because I couldn't believe that here I am, a Native person, standing in front of you, telling you it's not okay. I'm telling you why. I'm explaining to you how these things are sacred. And you just don't even care. And I was getting real worked up, crying. And then he grabbed me by my shoulders and he goes, "What do you want from me? What do you want me to do?" Because he was just getting real flustered. And I said, "Give me the headdress." He gives it to me. And I was like, okay, problem solved. It's over now. Somehow security comes over, the Native friend in the group that said the headdress was okay, who had bought it online. He had came back from wherever he was screaming around. He wanted his headdress back, and security didn't bother to ask any questions or anything. They just started demanding I give it back. And I thought, you got to be crazy if you think that I, as a Native woman, am going to hand this manifestation of so many things that are wrong back to these drunk white guys. Like, you got me on another level if you think that that's going to happen. So I refused to give it back, and they escorted us out back behind the bleachers, and Giants official made the decision to throw us out, and the police grabbed me by both arms, twisted them around behind my back, trying to lift me up almost by it. So I started screaming for someone to record what was happening and tell them. I was telling the police, let me go. I'll walk. I'm not resisting you. You're hurting me. And they wouldn't put me down. And I guess they just got tired of me screaming. So they grabbed me by my hair and threw me on the ground. And then Kimball, who had been recording, he got knocked on the ground by four officers. And then they detained us for over an hour.
These are the police.
Yeah, these are the police now that got
and
physical.
And they detained you for over an hour.
Yeah, it was about the fourth inning, I think, when we had went to approach these guys. And they kept us until the game was over.
Really?
At least for five innings.
And where did they keep you?
Kimball had gotten put in a police van, and I was in cuffs standing outside the van because there was no female officer there to search me to put me in the van. Although one of the male officers did decide to put his hand in my front and back pocket and feel me up anyways.
This was a cop.
San Francisco PD.
Who searched you, a male.
Yeah, and I was screaming, "I want a female officer, don't touch me, get away from me."
Do you know
me.
His badge number?
His name was Officer Cotter. I don't know the number, though.
Okay. And so you're alleging that he mishandled you.
Oh, yeah.
Physically.
I understand that you have no female cops there, but then you don't lay hands on me. You need to call a female cop in or someone else. That's not okay. Even at the airport, they know better than to do that.
So what was going through your mind at this time? Your Native American day here at the San Francisco Giants turned into you being brutalized, arrested, your beliefs being insulted, and the San Francisco Giants enforcing the insult. This is what you call, you know, rubbing salt on the wound.
Definitely. To me, it just was kind of an eye-opener that the team wasn't having this night because they really cared about Native people or the issues affecting us or even our cultures really that much. It's more so just a way to make money, just a publicity stunt. And that became very clear once these actions started unfolding.
All right, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with April Negrete. She, along with another Native American indigenous folk, Kimball Big Horse, were brutalized at the Native American Heritage Night sponsored by the San Francisco Giants. Talk a little bit about today. I understand that you had a meeting today. You were invited. This is actually a couple of hours before a planned protest.
Yes.
That you all are having. Right, you're planning to protest tonight. Yeah, is that right?
Yeah, a demonstration has been planned for this evening at 6:30 at the park. We're going to gather by the Willie Mays statue on
there.
The northwest corner.
And you're asking people to come down and join you and support this incredibly negative and violent decision by the Giants to, instead of honoring Native Americans, beat them up. So you're asking for support?
Yes, we definitely would like physical support of people being there. It's great for people to be online, but if people could be there to physically show that this isn't okay and to stand up and do something and say something, kind of the way that I stood up and said something to this guy, that would be greatly appreciated. Because just standing around hoping that it's going to change, it's not really working. It hasn't been working for us for years and years and years.
And yet there is momentum now, and we're going to get to that in a moment. But so let's come back. So you met with, you were invited in, you and your Kimball Big Horse were invited in to meet with officials of the Giants?
We met with the person in charge of the special events days, and then we met with I can't remember her title exactly. She's like a vice president or executive something of, I think it might be public
relations.
Do you
have their names?
Stacy Slaughter was the name of the vice president lady, and the other guy's name was Fahim something. The last name was long.
So they invited you. How did they invite you? Did you get a letter, a note, a phone call, an email?
We had been on the same email thread as them, and they got our email from that and contacted us that way. I think they might have called Kimball as well.
And invited you both to come down. And so why did they say, please come down, we want to talk to you, we want to understand better what happened to you?
Their words were, we want to discuss the incident that took place on Native American Heritage.
So there were no apologies in that invitation?
No. And actually, Kimball made a comment to me, because I had a missed call from a 415 number. Kimball made a comment to me that the man didn't want to leave me a voicemail. And I thought that was kind of strange.
All right. But tell. So what happened today? What did they say to you? Did you express your concern as you are here in terms of the way you were treated and the racism, the insults that you thought were a part of them enforcing folks, allowing them to wear these racist headdresses?
We did. We went into the meeting and they were very apologetic about what happened. They apologized for the way we were treated, that the incident took place, and they kind of just reiterated what sounded kind of like a mission statement to value community or promote community diversity of Northern California. Stacy mentioned that they want to learn and move forward from this event. They don't ever want their fans to feel alienated. Their goal is to enrich the community and celebrate. And
so
they want
they said
people
all
to be
these
comfortable.
Things. They said all these things. These are the things that you had come that night to sell it, to be a part
of,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I took notes on
these
everything
values.
She said. Yeah.
So these were this is what you were hoping when you came to this special night that the San Francisco Giants were calling, you hoped that they would be expressing all of these values.
Oh, definitely,
but,
especially on Native American Heritage.
But you got arrested up, beaten, thrown around, and ejected.
Yeah, sure did.
So when you had your dialogue today, did you feel like, did they say, we're going to do A, B, C, and D? We feel very bad, here's season tickets for you and your friend, and we're going to make a public statement that this is wrong and that all Indigenous communities are welcome. What did they say? Any promises?
Well, they asked what we thought would be good solutions to what happened, because we all agreed we don't want this to ever happen again. And me and Kimball told them that we would like, in the dress code or in the list of prohibited items, we would like cultural items such as headdresses and blackface and other things like that included in that list of things that aren't allowed in the park, because there are a lot of people that are offended by those things, even if a lot of people may not think twice about them. We also said that we wanted a public statement from them addressing what happened and apologizing for it, because here it's been 8 days and they haven't said anything. It hasn't even made our local Bay Area news at all. We also want all of the staff, is particularly the security, to go through cultural sensitivity training so they can understand that when they're trying to diffuse these conflicts that they're trained to diffuse, that they can have some background to try and understand what may actually be unfolding.
What did they give you? This is your ask. What did you get?
They did a lot of head nodding and said that they learned a lot and that they would discuss it internally and get back to us.
Did they apologize for you being arrested and beaten?
Yeah, they said they apologized that it happened. They didn't say specifically that.
Did they accept responsibility for the fact that this was in private property? So if the cops are going to arrest you and beat you, they're calling the cops in. So this is ultimately the buck stops with the Giants. Did they say we realize that, you know, we in fact did ask the police, maybe we didn't expect that they'd be so brutal with you? Because obviously it's their responsibility. They're making the call to have the police act. Any apology about that?
No, they actually tried to blame the police for making that decision on their own. We kept saying, well, who was the person that made the call to do that? And they both just kind of looked really confused and said, well, I don't know. It was probably SFPD's decision.
And to come onto private property and arrest a couple of Native Americans that were in the middle of the stadium somewhere.
Yeah, that's what we were told.
Yeah. So again, obviously, this is happening in a national context.
Yes.
You must be inspired because there have been major victories mm-hmm. in terms of indigenous communities being respected. You would think that here in San Francisco, given their knowledge of what's happening at the national level. I guess it's the Washington Redskins, I guess, that just lost their copyright or whatever it is on that. So there's big things. Then you got the guy in L.A., similar situation in terms of racism, a basketball owner who has said, no, we don't tolerate this kind of treatment, this kind of racism. So you're in the midst of a tide of change. I guess that must be an inspiration for you to know that you're part of that movement.
It is. I've followed this for as long as I can remember, and I'm very happy that it's finally getting talked about on a large scale and on a national level. But it just amazes me that it's 2014 and we're still talking about this. I still have to convince people as to why these things are offensive. And that really doesn't make sense to me. But at least we're moving in the right direction, even if it is incredibly slowly. And I hope that now that this has happened to me and Kimball, that it'll go even farther because we've been brutalized in the process. We weren't just asked to leave. We weren't just thrown out. We weren't just not listened to. We were assaulted.
And you're still in pain.
Yeah, I still can't lift my arms up all the way because they're still so sore.
And yet you're willing to go back tonight. You are calling for people to come out tonight and support this movement for Indigenous Indian rights in the United States. That's what this is, right?
Yeah,
for you.
It is. And also not just for Indigenous rights too, but for anybody, really. The Giants have multiple different community heritage nights, and this could happen to any community. So I think we need to draw on that support and support each other as underrepresented people from all over the world to make this happen, because clearly the people that can afford to buy all this time and have these luxuries don't care, and they're not going to do it willingly, or they're not going to do it in the right way willingly. They'll do it in a way where they can make a couple bucks off it. But we need to look out for each other, and we need to protect each other in that way.
Thank you, April, for being with us on Flashpoints. You're a very courageous young woman. Thank you. Feel better soon.
Thank you.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Flashpoints on KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's the bike show. It's 10:59, almost 11, and today's show, the topic will be bike packing and long-distance cycling with various guests. It's going to be a great show. Hope you can hang on for that. Thank you, members, for your generous support. If you're not a KABU member, you can become one by going to kabu.fm and clicking on Donate Today. We have a couple of announcements to lead us into the bike show. So we'll see you on the other side of that.
You put a big black blob in the middle of Canada and you reach out a tentacle to every part of the coast. There's a giant octopus that's essentially wrapping its tentacles around North America.
I find it marvelous how people can somehow drive down a 18-lane freeway in their SUV, cursing and swearing about products for the oil sands coming to California. As Pogo said, we've seen the enemy and he is us.
This Monday, July 7th, Locus Focus presents a special presentation of a new documentary by Barbara Bernstein. Fighting Goliath is a story about the frenetic exploitation of the Canadian tar sands and its rippling effects across the continent. Tune in on Monday, July 7th from 10 to 11 a.m. to KABU 90.7 FM in Portland, 91.9 FM Hood River, 104.3 FM Corvallis, or listen online at kboo.fm.
KABU is proud to co-sponsor and broadcast live from the 2014 Safeway Waterfront Blues Festival. The 27th annual festival will take place July 3rd through the 6th, 2014, at Tom McCall Waterfront Park. It will feature Greg Allman, Los Lobos, Lee Fields, and The Expressions among the 100-plus acts that will perform over the four-day festival. The 27th annual Waterfront Blues Festival will benefit the Oregon Food Bank. More information on artists, tickets, and the KABU broadcast of the festival can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from City Bikes, a worker-owned, cooperatively run new and used bicycle sales and service shop with two locations on Southeast Ankeny near KABU. Open 7 days a week for your bicycle commuting needs and online at citybikes.coop. And also by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Here comes the bike show.